In rural Iowa, it feels like there's plenty of room. But almost all of the land that makes up those seemingly endless wide open spaces is owned, occupied, and in use. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we continue our series, Ripple Effects, exploring Iowa's environmental challenges with an in-depth look at rural land use. Of the 36 million acres that make up the state of Iowa, just about a third of that land is dedicated to growing crops. The decisions that farmers, ag businesses, county governments, and rural homeowners make affect our water, soil, air, and quality of life. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we continue our summer series, Ripple Effects, exploring Iowa's environmental challenges with an in-depth look at rural land use. Coming up today at noon on River to River, we'll talk about urban land use. But this hour, we'll talk crops, livestock, development, and rural blight, and how the decisions made by rural landowners, farmers, ag businesses, and other stakeholders affect all of us. You can share your questions and concerns on our Facebook page. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're going to start with crops. And my first guest today is Chad Hart. He is an associate professor of economics and a crop market specialist at Iowa State University. Hello, Chad.
Hello, Charity. How are you?
Very good. Thank you so much for being here today.
It's my pleasure.
And we have about 36 million acres of land in Iowa.
That is correct. And I want to actually clear up something. In your intro, you said one-third was used for crop production. It's actually two-thirds is used for crop production.
All right. Well, so two-thirds of that is used for crop production. How does that figure change over time? Has that been holding pretty steady?
That has been holding pretty steady. If you look back over the past century, we've had roughly 24 to 26 million acres in crop production over that entire century. What tends to happen is the crops shift within the crops, but we don't necessarily add a lot of land to the crop base.
All right. And when we're talking about crops, I mean, right now, when we drive through a rural environment, we see a lot of corn, we see a lot of soybeans. Are those the dominant crops on that two-thirds?
Those are definitely the dominant crops. As you look out there this year, for example, we've got 13.6 million acres of corn, over 10 million acres of soybeans. So you're talking about 23.7 million out of that 24 to 25 million acres of crops being just corn and soybeans.
Now, we know that there are a lot of corn and soybean acres out there, but that moves around every year, right? I mean, it's not always the same fields. We talk about crop rotation, but it's a more complicated process even than that.
It is a more complicated process even than that. You do have some fields that would be continuously in the same crop. You do have a lot of fields where you may have a one-year rotation, a two-year rotation, or even a three-year rotation out there. And it's that rotation also shifts depending upon crop prices and where farmers see the best economic value.
In recent years, we've seen corn prices being very high. Of course, last year we had flooding in the spring. That shifted the balance back towards soybeans a little bit because we lost some corn acres or just didn't ever get them in the ground early in the spring last year. How do corn and soybeans kind of compare to each other?
Well, in this case, it varies year to year. As you mentioned, last year and this year, we did see a slight shift to soybeans. Actually, it was larger this year, and it was due to a couple of factors. One, as you mentioned, the high crop prices that we've experienced over the past several years. This year, they tended to favor soybeans in the early springtime. And then the rainy season that we've had here throughout the spring, delayed planting. And when you delay planting, farmers tend to move from corn to soybeans.
Now, with the high prices in recent years, we have seen some farmers taking some of their acreage out of the Conservation Reserve Program and putting it back into row crops. How significant has that trend been from your perspective?
We've had quite a number of acres come out, and it's due to a couple of factors there as well. As you mentioned, the high crop prices definitely have enticed acres out. But at the same time, the federal government has restricted how many acres could be in the CRP program, and so they sort of forced some acres out as well. If you look over the past 7 years, we've probably had 800,000 acres here in Iowa shift out of that program.
Also, something else that we've seen in recent years is the trend to pull out some of those hedgerows and fence rows at the edge of cornfields and soybean fields to maximize acreage. Is that a trend that you follow as well?
It is, and it's something that, does add a little bit of acreage on the side. And again, it's one of these things that I think tends to happen when you see the higher prices, and you'll see those hedgerows return back in as prices moderate down again. Farmers do respond to those market prices definitely in their acreage decisions.
I want to bring Jim Gillespie into the conversation as well. He's the Director of Soil Conservation for the Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Hello, Jim.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when we look at farming practices, of course, a lot of us are concerned about soil conservation. A lot of farmers are concerned about soil conservation. What is really at stake for farmers? How much topsoil do we tend to lose?
Well, you know, on average across the state, it could be related somewhere in that 9 tons per acre. You know, it kind of varies across the state. Some places are more erodible than others, but on average, we're somewhere in that 8 to 9 tons per acre a year.
Now, of course, when I was a kid, I remember a lot of fall tillage, and throughout the fall and winter, whenever there were big winds, you would see the soil blowing away, and you don't see that nearly as much anymore. We've changed a lot of practices on farms over the years. Have we gotten a lot better at conserving topsoil?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think farmers are realizing that the soil is the source that is their production factory, and so when they take care of the soil, they know that they're going to be able to raise those crops and grasses and food sources and that type of stuff. So they find it important to protect those soil resources, and so we're doing all we can to try to keep that soil in place.
Where in the state would you say soil erosion is worse?
You know, it does vary across the state, and you know, I always think if you thought of the state as kind of a square symbol, and we looked at the geographic, we have kind of the Wisconsin Glacier that kind of came down and formed the horseshoe through the central part of the state down to, say, Des Moines and back up. You know, some of our higher rates might exist in the western, southern, and eastern side, but we still can tend to have some erosion in that low barrier as well because of some rolling topography or even may be susceptible to wind erosion. But, you know, it's going to vary across the state based on the land use and what's actually happening on the land out there.
Well, and let's talk about some of the decisions that I was just talking about with Chad a moment ago. And for whatever reason, we've seen a lot of acres taken out of the Conservation Reserve Program. And as Chad pointed out, that's not all farmers making that decision to put them into production, but really economic pressure sort of pushing them in that direction as well. But we've seen a lot of hedgerows pulled out. Are we monitoring that? I mean, are we seeing more soil erosion because we have maybe more marginal land being put back into production and are farming closer to streams and to edges?
Well, and again, I think that can vary from field to field or farm to farm or parts of the state. You know, there are some things that are within the landowner or farmer's control as to the management of the land. And then in some cases, Mother Nature, which is the most uncontrollable and unpredictable thing that can tend to cause some erosion by heavy rains or strong winds or, you know, those types of things. And so I think the landowner and the farmer has to look at these things from a business standpoint to try to protect that resource. And so when the producer, farmer and landowner looks at that, they have to decide what are the types of things I can do to best protect the soil resources so that it'll stay productive this year, next year, and into the future, and try to do that in a sustainable fashion, but yet from a business standpoint, be able to stay economically viable in the production area.
Now, Chad, we have seen some changes in ideas about how to conserve soil in our fields, people putting in different contours and planting strips of native grasses, for example. Do you track that kind of acreage as well?
We don't necessarily track that, but we have seen an uptake of that. The one thing we do track is the use of cover crops. You know, after the corn and soybeans are harvested, you can still get out there, plant what's called a cover crop that would be there during the winter time when the corn and soybeans aren't growing to help hold the soil down. And over the past 2 to 3 years, we have seen a substantial increase in the use of those cover crops. So we do definitely track that.
Jim, I'm curious. I understand, of course, farmers are business people, so they have to look at their bottom line. But I'm curious if we know a little bit about the difference between the uses of conservation practices in row crop fields between people who are farming on land they own and people who are farming land that they rent. Do we know about differences in practices there?
Well, first of all, I would say the types of practices that they're choosing, whether they're owner-operators or whether they're, you know, just an owner protecting land that's maybe farmed by a tenant. The practices basically are the same. I mean, they're choosing to do, as Chad indicated, cover crops, or they're choosing to do a permanent practice like a terrace or a grade stabilization structure or a waterway. I think, you know, when you think about the landscape out there, or even forms of tillage, which, you know, can impact all acres, whether, you know, wherever they are in the state, I think people who choose those practices are doing a multitude of those. It's a systems approach, and so there's probably some form of conservation practice being implemented on almost every farm. Like I said, that could be in the form of a minimum tillage or a no-till or a strip till, up to and including, you know, some type of practice. Conservation practice, terrace, waterway, grade stape structure, whatever. So that's probably being utilized almost statewide. Now, you'll see some examples, you know, where there's some tillage occurring and you don't see that cover. But yet you'll see some areas that will come back into those, you know, when they tend to see that there's some resource issues out there.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Jim Gillespie, Director of Soil Conservation for the Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Chad Hart is here. He's Associate Professor of Economics and a Crop Market Specialist at Iowa State University. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're talking about rural land use this hour on Talk of Iowa as we continue our summer series on the environment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about rural land use as we continue our summer series, Ripple Effects, exploring our Iowa's environmental challenges. With me right now is Chad Hart. He's Associate Professor of Economics and a Crop Market Specialist at Iowa State University. Also, Jim Gillespie is here, Director of Soil Conservation for the Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. We're going to move on to animals, livestock, in just a moment, but you are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And Chad, in recent years, we've seen a lot of studies come out about crop rotation and what that can do for the land, for fertility, for the farmer's bottom line as well. But we see a lot of recommendations for having, let's say, 3, even 4-year rotations. In practice, we see a lot of 2-year rotations. And I've interviewed farmers who say they've had their fields in corn for 30 years. What do we know about how farmers are making decisions about crop rotation?
Well, I think when you look at the rotation, it depends upon the relative market prices of the crops that they might incorporate in that rotation. The standard rotation here in Iowa has been a 2-year corn-soybean rotation. you know, as crop prices, especially here, you know, 2007, 8, 9, favored corn, we saw more farmers move to continuous corn. Over the past couple of years, we've seen the balance tilt back towards soybeans, and we've seen more farmers move back to that two-year rotation.
There are other factors that are playing into that. Now we see the return of the corn borer. Do you think that we'll see more rotation in future years?
I think we will. You know, as we look, the research continues to go on about the other benefits that come about when you look at the variety of crop rotations. As you mentioned, the idea of that when you have a crop on a field continuously, it allows disease pressures to build up, pest pressures to build up. That's kind of hard for me to say this morning. But, you know, and the idea is that rotation tends to break those barriers down and keep them in control longer.
Now, Jim, back to you. We were talking about the different practices that farmers put into play in their fields. And sometimes we see fields where there's a tremendous amount of erosion. And for whatever reason, things are either going wrong, and of course we have a lot of different factors that go into play, or there's a farmer who's making the decision not to make changes to preserve that soil. If there is a situation where there's a tremendous amount of erosion, are there policies, are there rules that could govern how that farmer approaches the next season?
Well, of course, you know, I think, you know, people who are dealing with issues, if something happens and they want to seek some technical assistance, I'd first of all ask them to stop in the local USDA Natural Resource Conservation Service office or visit with the folks from the Soil and Water Conservation District and get some technical assistance to try to deal with the issues. Now, when you talk about policies, there are some policies in the Code of Iowa that deal with soil loss complaints, that if somebody is receiving sediment damage because land's eroding onto their property, that person who's receiving that damage can file a soil loss complaint with the Soil and Water Conservation District and cause inspections to be made, which could lead to working with land above that drains onto that property to look at putting in practices that would resolve the issue and prevent further damage occurring to the person who was damaged property. Of course, on the federal side, you've got, of course, the compliance issues and participating in some of the federal programs require you to farm in certain ways. So, you know, there are some checks and balances out there that can help do that to try to, you know, protect that land. And of course, there are lots of financial resources through various programs from no interest loans, low interest loans, financial incentive programs through possibly local, but at least.
So there's help available for farmers. Are there penalties?
Well, you know, again, like I said, if somebody's required to put practices in place, you know, yes, there are timelines that are put in place that ask them to put those practices in, but there still could be some financial assistance to help put those in place.
Okay.
But they're given timelines to get those practices in to prevent future erosion from occurring.
And thus far, most recommendations seem to be along the lines of voluntary compliance. Okay. I want to get a couple of callers in here before we move on to animals. Dave is on the line in Dubuque County. Hi, Dave.
Hi.
What's your question?
Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
A couple questions or two versions of the same question. The elephant in the room, of course, is ethanol production. And I heard that it's like a third to 40% of our corn production goes to ethanol. And also the second part of that is the ethanol exports. Farm Bureau paper just reported that 78 million gallons of ethanol were exported last year. So how much, you know, so much for using it here in the United States.
Okay, so the question is how much...
What kind of issues are there here?
All right, Chad, so how does ethanol production impact corn production in the state?
Well, when you look at the state, we'll look back to, say, 2002. That was really before the ethanol boom, and we were planting back then around 12 million acres of corn. This year we're planting a little over 13.5. So we have seen some increase in the corn percentage of the overall cropland. So we have seen that shift. As the caller mentioned, the idea is that when you look at ethanol usage of corn, it does represent 30 to 40% of the total corn crop is devoted to ethanol, and a small percentage of that ethanol is exported. But when you look at the overall impact of land, it's been relatively small. The land that the corn's being grown on was already cropland before ethanol came to be.
Okay. I want to take Elise's call in Des Moines. Hi, Elise.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah. Quickly, what's your question?
You speak about the farmer as an individual. What percent of land is corporation-owned, large corporation, that doesn't pay attention to erosion factors or rotation, just kills that land for the biggest buck? The same thing will apply to animals, corporate hog confinements, chickens, where they don't really, they're not good stewards of the land compared to the individual.
And right. Chad, can you respond to that? That's a concern that a lot of people have, especially after the farm crisis in the 1980s, when a lot of family farms went out of business and became corporate farms.
Well, and that is a concern that many people have. However, when you look at the vast majority of our farmers here in the state, they are owner-operators in this state. When you look at the number of farms that we have here, we still have in Iowa 20,000 farms that are considered 10 to 49 acres. We have another 20,000 that are less than 180 acres. So you do see a lot of small farms out on the countryside as well. And when you look, I think, at the what's known as the corporate ones, they are under the same pressures as those individual operators. They've invested in that land to have it being productive, and therefore they are looking to protect the soil because that is their long-term return, if you will, on investing in that land.
And Jim, do you see any difference between how corporate-owned land is farmed as opposed to family-held land or privately-held land?
Well, I think, it could. Now, I don't have any statistics that would tell me how much is under corporate ownership or whatever, but I think as time goes on and the number of landowners, we might tend to see more, let's say, absentee landowners and people who aren't as connected to the land as has been in the past, who were the owner operators who lived on the farm and now it's passed on in the family, or there, just changes that occur. And part of, if you call it a challenge or an opportunity, is we'll be working with those folks and trying to reach out to them to help them better manage their lands. And we'll continue to do that to try to help them manage that land in a sustainable way, but also, help them do it from an agriculture or profitability standpoint. But there will come some challenges as people get more disconnected from the land.
Jim, thank you very much. Jim Gillespie is Director of Soil Conservation for the Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. Chad, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Chad Hart is Associate Professor of Economics and a Crop Market Specialist at Iowa State University. We're going to move on to livestock now. And with me is Ken Hesenius. He is Supervisor for Iowa's DNR District 3 office in Northwest Iowa. He works with Animal Feeding Operation Permitting. Hello, Ken.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
And, I think we hear a lot about CAFOs in this state, concentrated animal confinement operations, but there are a number of different animal feeding operations out there. Can you draw a distinction for me?
Right. CAFOs, actually, the acronym CAFO, it means two things in Iowa. One's confined animal feeding operation, and the other is concentrated animal feeding operation. So there's a bit of a difference, particularly on the regulatory side there. However, when we talk about confined animal feeding operation in Iowa, we simply mean that they are confined under roof to a building. The other main type of operation that we see and is very distinct in Iowa law is open feedlots, and those are particularly in Iowa now are animals that are held in pens that aren't confined to buildings, so that when rainfall falls on those pens, it's subject to runoff. So in Iowa, we have confinements and open feedlots.
All right. And of course, farmers have had livestock forever, and farmers make a lot of decisions about whether they want to have livestock,
right.
They want to have cattle, they want to have pigs, that kind of thing. At what point does the state get involved, or the federal government, for that matter? At what point do farmers need a permit to have a certain number of livestock in a certain amount of
right.
space?
Right. There's quite a bit of difference in size depending on what kind of operation you have. Typically in Iowa, the size limitation is 500 animal units, so without getting too much into detail, that would be 500 cattle or 1,250 hogs is when those animals in confinement would require a minimum of a manure management plan and some oversight on those operations. So that's kind of the lower end. There can be some argument that any animal feeding operation is regulated. Quickly on the federal side, a concentrated animal feeding operation typically is 1,000 animal units, and again converted into hogs and cattle, that's 1,000 cattle and 2,500 head of hogs. There are also some regulations reaching down a little smaller into medium animal feeding operations on the federal level that goes down to 300 head of cattle and 750 head of hogs.
Okay, so a farmer can make a decision to have a large number of animals on his or her property without needing a permit.
Yes, I mean, in the olden day, of course, up to 1,000 head of cattle was a very large operation, but, up to 2,500 head of hogs was also a large operation. But in today's world, those numbers have been creeping quite a bit higher than that. So you can still have a substantial number of animals on your farm with a relatively minor amount of regulations attributed to those operations.
Do those smaller operations have to have manure management plants? I mean, you have 500 cattle, that's still a lot of manure.
That's right. So, that again, everything's relative. You know, that manure for smaller operations, at 400 head of animals is still a substantial amount of manure, and farmers by and large want to manage that because it's a valuable resource.
We see a lot of news stories about manure spills, large and small, in Iowa, and of course you track fish kills at the
right.
DNR.
Right.
How significant is this source of pollution in Iowa from your perspective?
From our perspective, of course, any spill is significant, and it can have a very large impact locally on a stream if it's impacted. But if you put the thing into a state of Iowa perspective, there are millions and millions and perhaps several billions of manure handled each year in the state of Iowa. And by and large, the percentage of accidents is relatively small. It's just that when you have one, the impact can be relatively large.
Once one of these very large animal confinement operations gets a permit,
mm-hmm.
how are they monitored?
Well, we do an active inspection program. We visit and inspect those facilities on a routine basis. If they have problems, we can check them periodically. We do have a large number of facilities in Iowa and a relatively small number of staff to do those inspections. So, it's a balance between spreading those resources out among those operations.
Have you ever had to shut one of those operations down?
No, that's typically not a response that the DNR has. And in fact, in our rules and regulations, we really don't have a mechanism, if you will, to actually shut an operation down. We choose to work cooperatively with those operations that are having problems and get them into compliance so that they can be environmentally sound in those operations.
Okay, so even if they are repeat offenders, they don't get shut down?
There is a provision in Iowa law for what we call habitual offenders, and they are restricted if you become classified as a habitual offender in getting more permits. But again, we don't have the regulatory authority, if you will, to shut an operation down.
We have just a minute left here. Ken, can you give me an idea of how many animal feeding operations there are in the state of Iowa? First, let's talk about the ones that are bigger than 500 head of cattle and bigger than 1,250 hogs.
We've got several categories there, and I'll point out some of the highlights. Again, this is data taken from our animal feeding operation database, and we have a confinement inventory in Iowa of 7,144 plus or minus. That would be confinements that we regulate that would have manure management plans or some kind of regulatory aspect to them. We have a registered number of open feedlots of 2,151. Again, that number is relatively low because if they're below 1,000 animal units, we may not even know about them. We have a discharge permitted inventory of 170 operations statewide. And besides the 7,144.
You know, I'm going to have to cut you off there, Ken, but thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about rural land use on Talk of Iowa, a very big topic that we're exploring this hour. And just before the break, I was talking with Ken Hesanius, supervisor for Iowa DNR District 3 office in Northwest Iowa, who works with animal feeding operation and permitting. There are a lot of people who want to be part of this conversation today, and we're not going to have time to get to all of our calls and all of our questions. I'll read this email from Jerry. These were some thoughts that he shared after listening to our conversation about crops. He says, as a steward of 60 acres in northern Johnson County, I pay close attention to the land as I drive around our state. Despite what your experts are saying, I see very little evidence of the use of cover crops following beans and corn. I've also noticed a recent trend to bulldoze trees and brush on stream banks and plant right up to the waterway. So we're wasting our most precious resource, causing flooding and accelerating fertilizer runoff for what? A few extra bucks worth of corn? If landowners, private or corporate, are not wise enough to protect the land, there need to be legal penalties for abusers. That's Jerry's opinion, and of course we want to hear from you as well. Send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Now, when you drive through rural Iowa, in addition to the farms and the feedlots and the rural homes, you also see abandoned buildings, abandoned farms, sheds, houses, and schools. Underneath the big Iowa sky, near a beautiful verdant green cornfield, the buildings can look fairly picturesque, even beautiful. But we're going to talk about what kind of problems they might be representing in our environment as well, and what we should, or at least can, do about them. With me now is Scott Flagg. He is manager for the Derelict Building Program for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Charity. How's it going?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
And Siobhan Spain is also here. She's an independent consultant with Balin and Blanken and also has a lot of experience with researching Iowa's abandoned and dilapidated structures. Hi, Siobhan.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
And Scott, give us an idea as we look around. And Siobhan, you can jump in here, too, because I know you have a good idea of what's out there. But as we look around the environment in rural Iowa and we see these dilapidated structures, How common is that to have abandoned buildings that are no longer in use, just sitting on Iowa land or in our rural communities?
Well, Charity, there's quite a few buildings throughout Iowa that are in various stages of, you know, either being abandoned or derelict, as we qualify them under our program. Our program is working with communities of 5,000 or fewer to address, like you mentioned, like the public school buildings, abandoned commercial and public buildings in the downtown sections as well. I know for a fact that we have 869 towns in Iowa that have 5,000 or fewer people inside them. And inside those populations, we have identified at least 500 or 600 buildings that are potentially could be reused or deconstructed.
All right. And Siobhan, can you weigh in on that as well?
There are a lot. I mean, I'm kind of obsessed with the beauty of them, as you mentioned. And there are plenty if you take the back roads anywhere across Iowa. And there are people, artists and whatnot, that really love to photograph them because of their picturesque personality. And there's a huge amount. I don't know if they've ever been counted, but I know there's been some, like the DNR that Scott just mentioned, they're starting to make some headway in quantifying how many are out there.
And of course, as you mentioned, Siobhan, I mean, a lot of these buildings are beautiful, and a lot of these buildings represent a significant part of our history, both our family history and our state history in Iowa. But Scott, what are some of the dangers of having these buildings sitting there?
I think some of the main dangers we encounter on some of these buildings are like asbestos. There's asbestos inside the buildings. And when the building becomes abandoned and it's left, there's no one there to maintain it, the building slowly falls apart and eventually it crumbles. So when that happens, everything comes down. And then all the material that comes down with that has to be treated as asbestos contaminating waste. And that all has to be taken to the landfill. And then there's also an extra charge for how much when you take asbestos containing waste to the landfill. So not only do you have an issue there where a building's falling down in your main street area, but then you're also hit with the additional fees for taking the material to the landfill. On top of the asbestos issues, there's lead, there's mold. We have several of our applicants through our program talk about how the kids in the town like to go in and play in the abandoned buildings. So the towns, the city clerks, the mayors, they're concerned about people going inside buildings that they no longer maintain.
Well, and these are in rural communities, but also you see buildings in the landscape, like schools, for example, that were outside of small communities, maybe served more than one small community, but these have been abandoned as well. And so those buildings would also be causing some of those environmental hazards.
That's true. Yeah, we have several, like through our program, we've helped either remove or reuse at least four or five school buildings throughout the state of Iowa. In different, state of repair, for sure.
And tell me, give me a little bit of the history of the derelict building program with the DNR.
Sure. Yeah, the derelict building program was started in 2010. We're working with communities of 5,000 or fewer to address abandoned and derelict buildings. And what we're looking for there is commercial and public structures, like you mentioned, school buildings, the main buildings on the main street, things like that. We work with the cities and the counties if they own the buildings. They can apply to the program. It's a competitive program, and they can ask for funding for deconstruction. Now, deconstruction is different than demolition. You're not just coming in, knocking the building down, hauling it off. Deconstruction, you're coming in, you're either taking the building apart selectively or you're knocking the building down in parts, and you're separating those materials, and then you're finding markets for those materials. We also provide funding for renovation to help fix up the building, and if there's any sort of issues like asbestos, we help remediate asbestos. Provide $10,000 for that, and then asbestos inspections, phase one, phase two, any sort of environmental testing, we help with that as well.
With some of the smaller structures on farmsteads, for example, the abandoned sheds, the abandoned barns, and you know, even, goodness, you see a lot of farmsteads, particularly in western Iowa, where the house has been abandoned as well after the farm crisis of the 1980s. There's been a tremendous amount of change in how that land is used out there. What are some of the other hazards that might be hidden in those buildings? Not the commercial buildings, but the privately homed buildings.
Well, I think there's always, it's going to matter, you know, what you encounter. There could be paints, chemicals. There could be issues with, trying to think of like some residential properties, what I might run into in my own house. I'm kind of drawing a blank on some of that, to be honest with you, Charity. But I know that like one thing we can do, like with the DNR, is we can work with private residents as well as farmers. They can take advantage of our Iowa Waste Exchange program where they come out and maybe do like a waste audit, and so see what types of materials are out there in the house or in the barn, and they'd be able to find markets for those individuals, private residents, businesses, whoever's interested in that type of service.
Well, and you mentioned deconstruction. I mean, just anecdotally speaking, and I'm not going to name any names here, I know a lot of people who live in rural areas who've talked to me about what they did to get rid of their rural buildings. And, you know, I know people who've knocked them down and buried them. I know people who have burned them. And, you know, a lot of people, they just want to get rid of it. And there's a tremendous amount of, well, I'm sure danger there as well, but a tremendous waste of resources that if these buildings are disposed of in that way, isn't there?
That's correct. Yeah. Basically, you know, we want to work with the community if they have an issue there, like in a commercial and public building where they have to have it checked for asbestos before they bring it down. We can help them find markets through the program. You know, we have several vendors here within the state of Iowa that are interested in purchasing old brick, old lumber, things for architectural salvage, and actually the city or the county can generate some money off selling this material instead of having to pay to take the material to the landfill.
And Siobhan, I know that you recently worked on the deconstruction of an old outbuilding on your family farm. What was the building?
Well, it was our barn, our main barn, and that was actually several years ago. We've been it's just a common issue that has happened on farms where they have these barns and they used to farm the land themselves, and then they started leasing them out for conventional farming or larger farmers. And so there isn't any use for those barns anymore, and they get dilapidated, especially if the roof goes in. The best thing you can do is preserve the roof if you do want to preserve any outbuildings like that. So the reason of, you know, not having it and then the foundation was being compromised, you know, there was a danger, and that barn was close to our residence. And so my dad was very worried about the grandkids getting in there and, you know, falling through the floor or, you know, things like that. So there are dangers even in that. But I want to really put a plug in for not just the dangers, but the material, like you mentioned. It's quality material. That old growth lumber, even in sheds in people's landscape, there's so much great creative options for making use of that, because once you bury it or burn it, there's that old growth lumber that's just not in existence anymore. We worked on a renovation project of a foreclosed home recently in Des Moines, and we used some barn wood that my brother collects, and it was a huge feature in the house that people just gravitated toward because it has such a unique look and it's so durable that I really encourage people who do have those. I know they just want to get rid of them and they really don't want to think about it, because emotionally it's kind of tough to make those decisions on the farm too. It really acknowledges that time period in your farm is over, and that's what happened to us. That was the most difficult part about it, was the emotional aspect of it. But at least you can save those materials and make something else out of it, or there's just so many uses and a great demand for it and people who are really looking for it.
What kind of process did you have to go through with your family's barn? I mean, I understand it was an emotionally difficult time, but that sounds like a challenging job.
Well, you know, farmers are resourceful by trade. So, and, you know, growing up Irish Catholic, I have plenty of siblings, and they did it themselves. I mean, the siblings did. So it's took it down and deconstructed it mainly because, you know, when you're a farmer, you're most of them want to save things and find other uses. That's how you survive out on the farm and make things work. So we had to take care of the foundation was really given. So we slowly took it down piece by piece.
How long did it take you?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know how long it did. It's a process, because sometimes you have to push it over, and hopefully you push it in a way that's that saves the material. And that's another thing about deconstruction, which is so nice, is that it really helps preserve and doesn't ruin that material. Like metal and all those things can be salvaged out of demolition. But once you do that to wood, it's broken. It's not really that valuable anymore. So it's good to, some people start on the roof and some people do the outside and then pull it down once they get some of the siding off. And some of those outbuildings are so simple structures. They're perfect for deconstruction because they don't have a lot of interior aspects to it, like insulation and asbestos and all those things. So
not a lot of the complicating factors.
It's very simple.
What did you do with the materials from your barn?
Well, like I said, my my brother, Sean, is, I hope he doesn't take this the wrong way, a hoarder as far as that goes. And it's so to our asset because he's an artist as well. So he reuses them for tables and like he did the barnwood accents in the house that we just renovated. And they're just exquisite. So he is a construction worker by trade, an artist. So he really, in the farmer aspect, really brings that creativity all together and that resourcefulness. So we've found many uses.
Scott, when you're working on some of these other kinds of buildings, how long does it take you to deconstruct, let's say, an old school?
Well, it usually depends. I think usually we're going between 3 to 6 months for a deconstruction project, but sometimes it might take longer, and sometimes it might go quite a bit quicker as well. Probably on average, though, we've averaged between 2 to 3 months for each project.
And so far, since the program was founded in 2010, how much material do you think you've been able to keep out of landfills?
To this day, we've diverted a little over 10,000 tons of construction, demolition, brick, wood, concrete, asphalt, items like that.
And how many projects have you been able to complete?
Right now, we've completed 36, and we have had 20 projects that just started here on July 1st. So
wow.
We have our next round that's starting pretty soon here.
All right. And how many are on the waiting list?
Well, we've received 119 applications in total over three rounds, and we've ended up funding 56 projects. So there's still quite a few projects out there that we can help work with communities on addressing these types of buildings.
And if somebody's listening right now and thinking, wait, I didn't even know I could apply.
Right.
So when is the next opportunity for people to get involved?
Our next grant round actually will be next winter, be end of February. I think the deadline will be February 27th, 2015. But we're accepting applications whenever. And what we do is if someone calls me up and asks me, hey, Scott, you know, I got this building I need help with, we'll help them. I'll help them with their application, help strengthen their application, and then they can apply. And then the review committee, which is made up of Keep Iowa Beautiful, Iowa Recycling Association, a group of landfill organizations across the state, they review the applications and select who gets funded for the program.
And if somebody's interested in deconstruction on their own land, if they have an old barn that cannot be saved or an old outbuilding that really doesn't need to be saved, I mean, some of these barns are so beautiful, some of the outbuildings not as much. But Siobhan, where do they turn for information about deconstruction? How can they get advice on how to do this?
You know, there are programs in Iowa that have started up, which I was involved with at the Center of Sustainable Communities and the Iowa Waste Reduction Center, and we worked with DNR and Iowa Central. The deconstruction is a growing topic, but it's still, there's a lot of progress to be made. There are not, you know, there are contractors that don't put themselves out there as deconstruction specialists, but talk to your community members. Networking is the best thing that I can say, because like my brother will do it on the side. Dan Oswald out of Iowa Central will do it. So there are people out there. It takes networking at this point until we get the Iowa Green List populated.
All right. So start asking questions.
Yes.
All right. Siobhan Spain, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Siobhan Spain is an independent consultant. Scott Flagg, thank you.
Thank you.
Scott Flagg is manager for the Derelict Building Program for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. We're continuing our series today on River to River with an in-depth look at urban land use in the state of Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.